Thank you for coming tonight. Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series. We're a couple of weeks into it, and next week, Katrina Moorhead is here from Houston. Katrina is the recent recipient of the Texas Prize, and she's here to present her beautifully crafted, poetically considered, or poetically crafted, beautifully considered work, the likes of which you can now find at in the exhibition Material Culture at TCU's new art gallery space, Fort Worth Contemporary Arts, which is located at Berry and Green here in Fort Worth. Tonight we are so fortunate to have artist and writer Noah Simblis with us. And actually, artist and writer, while a very important part of who Noah is, are just two of his many roles. In addition, he curates, teaches, mentors, and never stops. Noah received his MFA from the University of Washington in 1999, and in 2000, he joined the Seattle Artist Cooperative, SOIL, or is it SOIL? So. Soil, where he curated the exhibition Abstraction Construction. Most recently, he curated the exhibition Collecting Collectivity that opened on the 15th at the Conduit Gallery in Dallas and is up, I believe, until March 15th? 22nd. March 22nd. It's a really smart, thoughtful, and handsome exhibition. Kind of everything you could want in an exhibition. It has been described as an exhibition of international artists who engage the broad array of ideas and forms created by the coupling of these two seemingly disparate terms, collecting and collectivity. In addition to the exhibition, there were multiple programs and coursework that was conceived and orchestrated by Noah at SMU, where he teaches painting, drawing, and criticism. He also runs an impressive lecture series at SMU that is for students but open to the public. And when you have the fortune of hearing about one of those, I really encourage you to go. They're quite impressive. Noah has written for the zine The Redheaded Stepchild in Seattle, the Texas-based GlassTire.com, Art Lies magazine, for which he was the co-editor with Michelle White for the most recent issue, and ZeroDegreesArt.com out of L.A., this scholarly activity is in partnership with Noah's approach to making art. Research and careful consideration of ideas and means are at the heart of everything he pursues. His work involves paintings, drawings, video, wall text, and sound installations that explore the limits of symbolic meaning in political, religious, and quasi-religious modernist iconography. Seeing Noah's work, if given the time and attention that it requires, leaves the heart and head full while satisfying the eye. Recent exhibitions have included the 2007 Texas Biennial in Austin, also last year, the Brewery Project in L.A., and 2006, the exhibition Tight at Andor Gallery in Dallas, as well as solo exhibitions, which have included Soil Gallery in Seattle, the MAC in Dallas, and most recently, Protocols of Zion at the Pollock Gallery at SMU. This was an exhibition with a fascinating premise that I hope we will hear more about tonight. As the announcement for this lecture stated, currently engaged with issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and always a student of art, Noah's work in all its forms questions if there is any possibility left for political content in abstract form. So with that compelling thought, let's get started, and please join me in welcoming Noah Simblis.
Thanks, Terry, and thank you all for coming. What I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about six projects from the past 3 years, so mostly recent work, that are going to be bracketed essentially by some of the other activities that Terry mentioned, a couple of curatorial projects and some writing. A couple of things to know before we actually start. I was brought up in a relatively religious, Orthodox Jewish, Zionist family and community. I moved around a lot, but sort of within each of those communities ended up in schools that, for instance, in my high school education, half of my courses were taught exclusively in Hebrew. And the idea of sort of Israel as the homeland, sort of the sense of ultimate origin was always very, very present. When I was 16, I sort of became or started the process of becoming secular, essentially rejecting a good amount of that education and upbringing, began a process where art making, and in particular painting practice and abstraction, became a sort of replacement. The history of modernism really uses a lot of utopian language that's both sort of spiritual in some ways, political in a lot of ways, and also sort of the notion of painting as a way to sort of construct oneself through constructing a relationship between self and the other. So the other often becoming symbolized by the painting as a kind of territory and a body at the same time. The way that the canvas ultimately became a kind of symbol for that almost existential struggle was something that was very attractive to me, and in a lot of ways constructed an alternate form of developing a daily practice. You know, Orthodox Judaism, for the most part, is about daily practice. It's about, you know, deciding how you eat, how you go to sleep, how you wake up, praying three times a day, how you speak, how you dress. Every way that you think about your body and the way that it exists in the world, and ultimately your construction of self in relationship to a community is very much rooted in daily practice. And the practice of painting for me became a way, initially, to sort of find a set of substitutes for that. When I was in graduate school, I sort of started this process of essentially reading. I mean, I had been reading for a long time, you know, things that had really sort of supported this kind of modernist ideology, but I began a process of reading actually after an argument that I had had at a table of graduate students. And I remember there was sort of one graduate student who was insisting on sort of, you know, Matthew Barney as being sort of the ultimate example of a contemporary artist. In the sort of grand tradition of the Cedar Bar, you know, sort of pounding my fist on the table and saying, no, you're wrong, Matthew Barney has nothing to put on the table. But I didn't really know why. And I started to really think about, not Matthew Barney per se, but sort of a set of ideas that were very present in the 80s and 90s that dealt with identity politics and the way that painting in particular and abstraction very much so had been rejected by a number of artists as some kind of hegemony. And so there were these two very radically split camps. There was, you know, the group of people who believed in sort of materiality and form and a sense of tradition, the tradition of the avant-garde, which in itself is sort of an odd idea. And then on the other side, there was sort of the post-media world, where materiality was just sort of one part of a larger set of ideas. And so through reading what, you know, for lack of a better word, can be called theory with a capital T, I started this sort of parallel track of, you know, in my studio, I was still very much rooted in that kind of daily practice of painting, making essentially these large, very gestural, materially based abstract paintings. And at the same time, being really rooted in a kind of Hegelian ontology, reading people like Lacan, thinking about like an essay, The Mirror Stage, was very important for me at that time. And in a way, in something I'm going to show you later on, it sort of raised its head. One of the ways that I was sort of working through this was through things outside of my own painting practice. So one thing that I did was put together, as a graduate student, this symposium called the Word and Image Series, where I'd invite a writer and an artist together in these pairs three times a year to sort of each give a lecture about their work and then to come together in some kind of dialogue. I also started writing for the zine, The Redheaded Stepchild, essentially sort of reviews of shows around town. And then finally, I curated this show, Abstraction Construction, while I was a member of this artist cooperative Soil. You can get the lights, please. So the images that you see in front of you are a collection of some of the artists that were in this exhibition, Abstraction Construction. Essentially, they were all artists that I knew, either people who I was a student with in graduate school or undergraduate, people that I knew from Seattle, also some former teachers. And in a way, it was sort of like realizing and embodying this kind of lexicon that really existed for one side of my practice. And the act of curation was really an extension of my practice as an artist. It was a way for me to try to work out really what my relationship to abstraction was outside of sort of myself as an individual in the studio, and then with the sort of the abstract ghost of, you know, sort of the voices of history in my head. So in some ways it was trying to actualize those ghosts, to see them in real space and to really think about what that side of the whole picture was really all about. One thing about abstraction, again, that sort of really related very strongly to the original kind of religious underpinnings of my intentions as an artist was this idea of form, meaning sort of line, shape, composition, these things that really provided a kind of understructure that even sort of in a Platonic sense was the essential truth, the purity that was underneath sort of in a microcosm, you know, the practice of painting, but in a larger sense, within sort of the universe as a whole. And, you know, often within a lot of artists' writings, people like Malevich or Mondrian, you'll find that kind of ambition, the idea that to essentialize things to their most basic parts, to look at the underside of things, is to reveal some sense of truth. And that was something that was actually quite appealing to me, the idea of sort of digging down to the truth and looking for some sense of purity. Okay, so I'm going to digress for a moment and then it'll make sense. These are three images from a film in 1990 called Europa, Europa. And it's essentially the story of this this boy who is born on Hitler's birthday. In the left image, you can see his circumcision 8 days later. Circumcision was something I was actually quite interested in at this time. The idea of the mark that's to some degree sort of self-inflicted as a kind of identification was something that in an odd sort of way related to the idea of the kind of existential mark that an abstract painter made. The idea that one could mark oneself as a kind of self-construction. The middle image is from a scene that happens a little bit later, where on Kristallnacht, this is during the early stages of the Nazi regime, where It's called The Night of Broken Glass. That's the direct translation, where essentially Jewish businesses and homes were sort of marked with these six-pointed stars to say that, you know, this is a Jewish business, and, you know, sort of revealing the hidden truth that existed within society, to some degree a very modern gesture. But the thing that was quite different about this is a mark that is about naming someone else, right? You know, they're two opposite gestures. One is to mark oneself, to name oneself, to identify oneself, and the other was to be identified by an other and as an other. The third image there on the right happens later on that day, because as Kristallnacht is unfolding and these Jewish businesses are being marked with these six-pointed stars, it's called the Night of Broken Glass because they weren't just simply marked. People ended up sort of throwing things through the windows and taking the Jews that existed in these businesses and beating them up or shooting them or whatnot. The character Solly, a nickname for Solomon, is taking a bath while all this is going on and is sort of like under the water, sort of in his own kind of adolescent daydreams, and doesn't even realize what's happening. Finally, he starts to hear the broken glass and, you know, runs out the window of the bathroom and sort of hides in an alleyway naked. Until sort of a friend of his, who actually is this, you know, a Christian Aryan from school, finds him a coat, the nearest coat that she could find, because a Nazi soldier had sort of left his at a truck down the road. So she gives him this coat, and he walks into this room to see his sister, who has died from the wounds inflicted on Kristallnacht, but he's wearing this Nazi coat. That then becomes a kind of foreshadowing for the later parts of the film, where he actually sort of gets lost and mixed up and ends up in the Russian army for a little while and in the Nazi army for a little while and finally ends up posing as an Aryan youth, where his circumcision becomes his greatest liability because as a teenager he's ultimately just trying to get by and is most interested in his Aryan Christian girlfriend. He desperately wants to sleep with her, but he doesn't want her to see his circumcision and to know that he's Jewish. And so this sort of like very sort of playful and almost ridiculous set of events ensue where, you know, his self-inflicted idea of identification becomes, in a way, his greatest liability. The thing about this film and this story that I was most interested in is really the kind of hybridity that that it really ultimately is about, that the purity of one always being, you know, always already being Jewish or always already being Aryan or always already being anything becomes quite quickly confounded. And that was an idea within identity politics and also as a way to think about a kind of critique of abstraction that I was actually quite interested in. Purity being a word that actually, in this case, was quite prescient in terms of one's notion of identity, but that at the same time, purity from a position of abstraction was also something that becomes quite difficult to reconcile. So despite the fact, in terms of biography, despite the fact that I grew up within this like Orthodox Jewish Zionist community, my mother converted. Most of the people that, you know, the kids that I went to school with didn't go to their grandparents' house for Christmas. I did, and that was always sort of an odd thing. So actually, as my family became more and more religious, when I was 12, my mother reconverted because the original conversion wasn't quite good enough. It was by a Reform rabbi, and we were becoming more Orthodox, and so she had to be reconverted. And when she was reconverted, my parents had to remarry. The whole process had to begin again. So my parents remarried, and then because Judaism is matrilineal, my two brothers and I had to convert as well. So we were taken to the mikveh, a ritual bath, and sort of dunked 10 times and with naked in this sort of huge hot tub, essentially. With the three witnesses were the principal for my school, my Talmud teacher, the sort of kind of oral law, which I'll get to later, and also my Bible teacher. So those were the three people who sort of dunked me through and passed me on to the stage of truth and purity, which became sort of an odd moment that I think it took me a while later to really sort of figure out, at least for myself, was actually quite problematic. There is an idea that exists where, all Jews, the souls of all Jews existed on Mount Sinai when the Torah was given, the Bible was given. By tradition, anyone who converts to Orthodoxy, their soul spontaneously sort of is created at that moment, a kind of retroactive sci-fi sort of time and space jump. These ideas of sort of the hybridity of identity were something that became quite interesting to me. In terms of abstraction and in terms of ways of thinking about how to sort of break notions of purity within painting practice, I started to think about sort of the rectangle, this sort of godlike form that all sort of formal notions are sort of derived from and folded back into. I started to think about the way that the rectangle was implicated within a larger space. Again, this is sort of as a notion of identity. This is sort of similar to ways of thinking about, if the rectangle, the canvas, the object is sort of the stand-in for the self. The way that the rectangle is implicated and has relationships to something outside of itself, and is sort of affected and even infected by that that outside environment. I started to become interested in the way that abstraction could function in an installation context. How does the object exist within a kind of architecture? How does one object relate to another object? So here on the left is a prawn room by the Russian avant-garde artist El Lizitsky. This is an artist who also was Jewish, and as a result of the Russian Revolution, became a part of this whole movement that really was looking for a way that abstraction could really point to like a new world, a new social order, a new spiritual order. And on the right is the famous Rothko Chapel in Houston. Rothko, also, who happened to be Jewish, born as Mark Rothkowitz, who later changed his name to Mark Rothko, also sort of had this notion of sort of constructing a way where abstraction could provide a kind of spiritual experience, something that was transcendent. And these are two artists who believed in the modernist essentialism and universalism as a way to transcend really the liability of their own Jewishness. One thing that that became actually quite problematic to me in thinking about the way that abstraction functioned for each of them was that in some ways there was this belief that abstraction was a kind of common language, well, everyone can see color, everyone can see like a rectangle and see the way that it exists next to something else. And that was something that could exist for all classes, all races, all people. It was something that was really universal. But at the same time, it also often became quite ideological. The thing that I've been interested in is the way that there really was something that was hidden even below that supposed lowest strata of purity at the kind of pared-down abstraction that each of them were engaged in. So what was that ideology? What exists underneath, sort of underneath the underpinnings of abstraction? Abstraction is something, you know, as a teacher, one thing that's actually been really interesting to me is how abstraction often needs to be explained. You have a student in front of a Rothko, and there are a lot of people who actually want to understand it. In fact, with the recent Declaring Space show, there's actually a couple of people in the audience, I think, here from... I did a little class in relationship to that, and it was very interesting that there was an enormous amount of conversation that was necessary to really put oneself into the position of seeing. And that really reveals a certain degree of ideology that's present not only in the work, but in ideology that surrounds the work. That ideology often is manifest in text. So within the history of modernist abstraction, one example of that is Clement Greenberg and many, many other people who've written about it. I was interested in the way that these texts also start to speak to one another. And the way that they frame abstraction. How does one thing inform another? How does one reading inform another? Which one is primary? Like, is the Rothko painting primary? Are his intentions primary? Are Clement Greenberg's writings primary? Like, which becomes the primary thing? And when is everything else mere interpretation? Or is everything simply interpretation? And yet, and the meaning is really a relationship and finding the real relationship that exists between those interpretive acts. On the left is a page of Talmud. Talmud, within Jewish tradition, is essentially a series of rabbinical commentaries that are commenting on each other, which are commenting on another commentary, which is commenting on the five books of Moses. And it's structured in a way where there's sort of a primary text, which you can see sort of in the central column, and then there are commentaries that exist on the right and the left, and then these little notes that exist on the margins that are commentaries even within that. And they all speak to one another. Talmud generally is usually written in Aramaic. Even the commentaries are sort of traditionally written in Aramaic. And they can span from being written anywhere from, say, like the 6th century through the 12th century, all the way up to the 16th century. On the right is a page of a book by the recently deceased philosopher Jacques Derrida. Derrida wrote this book, or compiled this book, quote-unquote, wrote this book about a relationship between Hegel and Jean Genet. And he even actually modeled it off of a piece that Genet had written that was actually about Rembrandt. And he had written this piece in two columns that sort of spoke back and forth to one another. And so what he was interested in doing was actually using the form as a way to talk about the form. And so I then sort of took this notion of text speaking, framing one another, and in turn framing abstract images, or on the other hand, abstract images framing the text, which in hand framed the interpretations, as the beginning of an installation. So this is really the first piece that I'm going to show you. This is... a kind of 360 view that was taken with multiple images to flatten out kind of like a map of this gallery. This piece was called Inside Outside the Whale. And it was all based on the Jonah story. In essence, what I was really interested in with this piece was to talk about the relationship of the art, the political role of the artist. The story of Jonah, everyone knows sort of Jonah getting, eaten by the whale. But Jonah is sort of, God comes to Jonah and says, Jonah, go tell the people of Nineveh. Nineveh, by the way, is a city and province in Iraq. Says, go tell the people of Nineveh that they're evildoers. Go tell the people of Nineveh that if you don't shape up, we're going to come and get you. So Jonah says, well, I don't know if I'm ready for this. And so he basically runs away, and he goes to the docks and gets on a ship, and the ship takes off. And then all of a sudden there's a storm, and all the people on the ship say, oh no, what are you doing? And so he goes back into the belly of the ship, and still the storm is going. And then they say, I think it's that guy. So they get him and throw him over. And then he, from the belly of the ship, he ends up in the belly of the whale. And from the belly of the whale, he finally sees the error of his ways. And he says this long sort of poetic prayer, you know, God, I'm sorry, you know, come and get me. So the whale spits him out, and Jonah sort of dusts himself off and says, okay, and marches himself off to Nineveh and says, okay, evildoers, you better shape up. And they do. And and they're saved. And Jonah says, wait a second, all this, and it was that simple? I mean, that's morality? You know, they're so awful that I have to go here and tell them that they're, you know, if they don't shape up, they're going to be destroyed. They're that bad. And all they have to do is say, okay, we won't do it anymore. And that's it. And so he has this like whole kind of argument essentially with God. Like, what's the point? Like, what is there any sense of objective morality in this whole thing? Without getting to at least sort of the intricacies of a Talmudic interpretation of the whole thing. I'm not so interested in the quote-unquote moral of the story in that sense. But I was interested in, as you could tell from some of my intonation, the notion of, this is as the Iraq War the contemporary Iraq War is unfolding. And I was interested in this notion of having sort of, you know, an outsider sort of pointing a finger and having a very clear idea of like what is good and bad and what our action should be in relationship to that. So that's the primary text, the central Talmudic column. Next to that was an essay by George Orwell, who wrote this piece called Outside the Whale. And he was essentially, strangely for Orwell, which I'm not going to go into, talking about how artists ultimately need to kind of go into their interior self as a kind of metaphor for, you know, the interior of the whale. That the inside of oneself, you know, the self is this ultimate kind of pure construct. That's where truth will lie, and the unending well of inspiration will lie. Salman Rushdie writes this response to him a little while later, and it's called Inside the Whale. And he basically sort of berates Orwell and says that, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, we're always political. All artists are politically implicated no matter what. Even if you're sitting on the inside of that whale, you're still implicated in some way. And then next to that was an essay by Edward Said. It was sort of a section of a book called Culture and Imperialism, where he kind of becomes a kind of mediator between these two different stories. And really sort of talks about how each of them has a particular position within that. And then next to that was a piece by Jacques Derrida called On Forgiveness. So I'm going to show you right now. This was my first attempt at a kind of animation. The sound that you're going to hear was recorded. It was actually a 30-minute piece that ran inside of the gallery. And there were two actors that read the entire text, and I layered them on top of one another. And it was recorded by it was recorded by a friend of mine in New York who mixed the whole thing. And anyway, that's what you'll hear right now.
The fact is, Sitting inside a whale is a very comfortable, cozy, home-like thought. The historical Jonah, if he can be so called, was glad enough to escape. But in imagination, in daydream,
but the fact is that being inside a whale is a very comfortable, cozy, home-like thought.
The whale's belly.
The historical Jonah, if he can be called so, was glad enough to escape. But in imagination, in daydream, countless people have envied him. It is, of course, quite obvious why the whale's belly is simply the whale's belly, big enough for an adult, big enough for an adult, in the dark, big enough ocean to space.
He might be wandering along the surface of waves or shooting down into the blackness of water seas, a line of deep wood and water, but you would never know shooting down into the black of the finest, unsurpassable stage of irresponsible
darkness, shooting down into the 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 darkness.
Okay, so here are a couple of images of the text on the walls. And as you can see, I sort of was trying to mimic the way that both, say, like that page of Talmud and that Derrida text were used. This was a grid of drawings, and the drawings, as you started to see in the beginning of the video, are really started by sort of charting out the grid of the rectangle, sort of a vertical line down the center, a horizontal line down the center, two diagonals, and they started to construct this essentially a kind of large cube that was made up of seven other cubes. And each of those cubes I then wrapped around these signs like a red cross that was equal-sided, which is called the Jerusalem cross, that was used by crusaders, the six-pointed star that was both closed and open, and then also the ten sefirot, the tree of life, which is a kind of map of the universe and a map of the human body that's used in Jewish mysticism. And I sort of wrapped each of these cubes around with these signs. So here's a sort of close-up of one with a six-pointed star, one using simply stripes. This one was with the ten sefirot. Each of these drawings are about 10 by 11 inches. Okay, so then really sort of coming out of my practice as an abstract painter, where I sort of like take one motif and then essentially riff off of that into another piece, I took the Derrida text that I had used in that installation and got a graphic designer to work with me on setting it up as a kind of vinyl wall text. Because the thing in the last installation that I was a little unsatisfied with was the way that even though the space had a relationship between drawings and text, they still were quite separate. So I wanted to find some way to stitch them together so that they could be more directly related. So this Derrida text was placed on the wall with these three drawings on one side and three drawings on the other. The three drawings on the other side had a wall painting of those stripes behind them. On a monitor to the right of all of that was an animated video. And the whole show and the video were structured around essentially three primary elements of contemporary Jewish identity, the Holocaust, Zionism, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Holocaust, which for me, I was using the gray stripes used in that were worn as by Jews in the concentration camps and these uniforms that they were forced to wear. The yellow star, similarly, and then the blue star, which sort of became a symbol for Zionism, the blue star that's in the modern-day Israeli flag. And then, say, on the image on the middle right, the colors of the Palestinian flag, which are actually the colors of the Arab Liberation flag, which are shared by most Arab countries in the Middle East. One thing that it was at its core is the Kaaba. At the center image there, the Kaaba is this sort of huge black cube in Mecca, which the Hajj is sort of centered around. The Kaaba was sort of built around this site where supposedly Abraham sort of set up this sacrificial altar. Abraham, by tradition, is both sort of the father of Isaac and Ishmael, right? Isaac being sort of the second of three forefathers of the Jewish people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then the 12 tribes of Jacob, etc. And then Ishmael, who by sort of Islamic tradition is actually the father of Islam. Both traditions considered each to be the firstborn. In chronology, Ishmael is actually the firstborn because Abraham takes Sarah, his wife, is barren, and so they agree together to have her servant have a child, and that's Hagar, and Hagar has Ishmael, but then Sarah sort of gets jealous, and they're both banished, and that begins a long, bloody story. So here is a slightly long-ish, it's about 4 minutes, video that went together with a piece.
Yes, there is the unforgivable. Is this not, in truth, the only thing to forgive?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولو شاء ربك
sees the victim understands the
as soon as she exchanges, speaks, agrees with her, soon the reconciliation has commenced. Imagine a victim of terrorism, a person whose children have been deported or had their throats cut. Can you still speak with the reasons? Forgive me, punishment. This madness is perhaps not so mad.
So the song that was sung sort of over the rest, I mean, including that section was from the Derrida text that the two actors were reading. There's also a piece by John Zorn that was laid into that. There's sort of the sound of the chants from this Nazi rally. The song that was sung over that was is sort of a traditional song that's based on the poem that Jonah had sung from the inside of the belly of the whale, which that Min Ha'amakim, like from the depths, Kerati Chaya, I call to you. And it's really sort of this sense of being sort of trapped in this interior space and asking for some kind of savior. So the drawings that were set up in relationship to this essentially riffed off of the same idea of the cube that I had used in the previous installation. And they had incorporated the ideas that I talked about already, the gray stripes and the yellow for the stage of the Holocaust, the gray stripes in relationship to the blue having more to do with Zionism, and the colors of the Palestinian flag. I mentioned earlier that there was this text that was important to me earlier on, the Lacan's Mirror Stage. And it was one thing that I was interested in was the way that symmetry set up these two halves that really were sort of part of the same whole, which ultimately is some of the behind the complexities of Derrida's argument in his essay on forgiveness. Because basically what one of the actors was reading is this notion of the moment that one understands the other, it becomes almost impossible to forgive because you become in the same... Once you understand the other, you become to some degree in the position of the other. And that, you know, unfortunately, it becomes this sort of cycle, right? That what the philosopher Hegel called the master-slave dialectic. I also set up these sort of cross forms together with these stars in relationship. In the center there is that tree of life, the ten sefirot that I talked about. Also sort of pairing the swastika in both sort of its in both of its mirrored forms, which would to me was sort of going back to its origin. You know, Hitler had basically appropriated the swastika from its origin in many places, but he had found it in India. And still today, it's actually quite common to actually find, as ultimately sort of a good luck symbol, sort of the cycle of life. And here again, sort of another way of posing the red cross on one side and the six-pointed star on the other with another incarnation of the ten sefirot in the center, the tree of life. The tree of life, actually, which became, you know, Jewish mysticism, its high point was really sort of in the 13th century, which a lot of scholarship over the past 20 years has actually looked at the cross influences between Christian mysticism, Islamic mysticism, and Jewish mysticism, often in Spain, because you know, Spain was occupied by Muslims in the south. Jews had sort of existed there for a long time until the Inquisition, and then there was a very sort of healthy dialogue in a lot of ways between these three traditions in many ways. okay, so this installation was called Homelands. I started it by going to Israel right after the last Lebanon War, And I spent a couple weeks there interviewing Israelis and Palestinians about their concept of home and its relationship to physical place. And I basically sort of took the sound from those interviews, in one case I made a video sort of connected back to the same motifs that I had used in the previous video. And I placed that on a monitor that had behind it this wallpaper that was designed based on that one cube drawing that was in the previous video. But it was, in this case, repeated over and over in a similar way that a lot of Islamic pattern and Islamic architecture works. So here you can see a detail of that cube repeated over and over again. So here's a short video. So that video used for the sound component an interview that I did with a woman, Adva Rodogovsky. Adva is Israeli. Her parents were Polish refugees from World War II who moved to Israel and were the founders of a kibbutz, a kind of communal farm in northern Israel. The kibbutz is sort of the basis of a lot of Zionism, and you know, because it really was about sort of looking to the land as the source of meaning. They were often secular, and it was sort of replacing the physicality of land with the ideology of Orthodox Judaism. She then moved, after sort of traveling around the world and moving to Tel Aviv, and then ended up back in Jerusalem and working for this organization called Ir Amim, which is an advocacy group for Palestinians living in East Jerusalem. So, you know, in the course of the interview, she had sort of, you know, it was in their offices, and she was giving me sort of the talking points of their organization. But I wanted to start the conversation just sort of asking about, you know, her personal history, like questions in Israel, like, where were you born? Where were your parents born? Well, if your parents were born in Poland, then how did they get here? Oh, well, you know, there was World War II, and the, you know, just sort of very basic questions lead quite quickly into these intersections of history and ideology. And so, you know, I had asked her the initial question of like, okay, well, what does home mean to you? And she had initially interpreted it through the mission of this organization in terms of Palestinians' homes and the Palestinian homeland. But after sort of getting involved for a good half hour in terms of her own personal story, I then returned to the question. And there's this moment in the video where you can hear this sort of like quiet laugh. And that was where she sort of like stopped for a moment. She said, oh, now I understand the question. Because to some degree, like understanding her own implication in this this conflict really helped her to sort of get to the core of this question of like, what is home and what is the you know, the value of a physical space in relationship to that. On the other side was this sort of listening station. That was painted with those gray stripes, with these two seats that had headphones for people. And then there were these flyers with an essay that I had written basically about my experiences sort of talking to all of these people. While I was there, I had sort of kept a blog as a kind of open diary, and in a way, like halfway through it, I really started to think that it was almost like a piece in and of itself, because, you know, being inside these conversations became almost performative. So here's an example of one of those conversations.
You know, home to me is where your loved ones are. Homeland is an important thing. To get to anywhere, you need to cross borders.
Fighting for this particular piece of land.
Remember, you're a Palestinian.
This is where I'm from. This is where.
Because really, it's completely abnormal. Really, situation that we have. Completely abnormal situation that we have. The space is the fact that you cannot move from one place to another. Racist discriminatory policies, racist in bureaucracy and paperwork in bureaucracy. Our problem is that we have two peoples in this land who are competing for who's the bigger victim. The Holocaust and what happened to the Jewish people is just unbelievable and tragic and amazing and unacceptable. But the Palestinians didn't cause it to the Jews. We had nothing to do with it. Whereas for us, the Israelis are causing us the suffering of our group.
You hear about the connections that the Arabs at that time had to Hitler and all
these
bloodthirsty and amazing how much it's much easier to be only a victim. We were alone, we were weak, but it's not the whole story. We expect people in order to live here.
The more the Israelis were fulfilling their Zionist dreams, the more the creation of their nightmare was taking place. It's amazing how much continuous suffering can be in one location.
So one of the things I was interested in was the way that space becomes a kind of ambiguous term. So the woman's voice in this is actually my cousin, who's American, who was raised relatively secular, who became extremely religious, and now lives in the West Bank. She changed her name from Jennifer to Leiba Chaya. And as she was speaking in the dialogue that I constructed with a Palestinian journalist named Daoud Katab, the third voice in that was a guy named Eitan Bronstein, who also sort of grew up on a kibbutz and now works for an Israeli NGO that works on it's an advocacy group for Palestinians, and what he does is he constructs these signs and has these tours of destroyed Arab villages. The thing about space that was interesting is that, you know, she's in the beginning, Leiba Chaya is basically saying, like, oh, there's nothing much there, it's just a few lines and a few colors. What she was referring to is the Negev Desert and her experience living there for a while. But I thought it was sort of interesting in its relationship to abstraction. And also sort of the kind of seeming neutrality of something like desert in relationship to the land of Israel, and also abstraction in relationship to the sort of political constructs that I had sort of placed in relationship to these abstract constructs. This is a piece that was part of a group show that was another short video. The sound of it came from interviews The other parts of the sound were from recordings from a walk that I did through the Old City of Jerusalem. And when you walk through the Old City of Jerusalem, you pass from the Jewish quarter to the Muslim quarter to the Armenian quarter, which is Armenian Christian. So this was taking one round through those three quarters in relationship to these interviews.
To open them up to the victimhood of the army.
People ask if you speak Arabic or Hebrew, because it sounds like we are all the same. We're not, and that's a problem.
It started because of us, not because of them, because we didn't know how to treat refugees, even though we were refugees.
So like a lot of the other videos, the bells that you're hearing are the bells from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which, houses these various stages of the Passion. And also, this video didn't have it, but others have the muezzin, the call to prayer that's coming from the Dome of the Rock, which is just, about 100 yards over, which is also sort of what Jews call the Temple Mount, which is the former Second Temple. Okay, another project, second to last, is from the Texas Biennial. Basically, I was given a shipping container, and what I did was to make 200 digital prints that came from the first video that you saw. So essentially the animation sequence that I did there was from, drawn animation. And what I did is, because the drawings obviously had to change, I sort of printed out each stage of their construction, which was 98 frames on each side. And then through speakers were the same sound pieces that listening station in the previous exhibition had as well. The thing that I was interested in was, again, this notion of mirroring, of like having one side sort of mirror against the other. At the end of that was a print that was a quote by Sartre, sort of connected to that idea of Lacan's mirror stage. I'll just read it really quickly. In the primordial reaction to the other's look, I constitute myself as a look. But if I look at his look in order to defend myself against the other's freedom and to transcend it as freedom, then both the freedom and the look of the other collapse. I see eyes and I see a being in the midst of the world. Henceforth, the other escapes me. I should like to act upon his freedom to appropriate it, or at least to make the other's freedom recognize my freedom. It's basically talking about the terrible conflict in sort of needing sort of the other to recognize one's freedom, but once one is forcing the other to recognize your freedom, they have no freedom, and you only need a free other to recognize your freedom, but to have them recognize it, you've sacrificed their freedom. And this was obviously placed in negative against one another. So each of these drawings was sent as a gift to one of the people that I interviewed. And this is something that I've never shown, and in some ways I sort of thought about it as a kind of like invisible performance piece. because the thing that I was constantly worried about through this whole structure was, how was I sort of objectifying each of them to, and sort of using them for this other project? And I was interested in at least, in some sort of quick and humble way, kind of making something that could be returned. The final project is the Protocols of Zion. And this was an exhibition that basically was structured with the following premise. Last summer, the SMU's dorms were actually sort of gutted and remodeled. And I sort of created this fictional story where the workers had found this stash of prints and drawings sort of behind the walls as they, you know, after they tore them down. And these prints and drawings and CDs and DVDs were made by this group, the new the New Elders of Zion. And what they wanted, essentially, this fictional group, was to use strategies of the Russian avant-garde to bring about the end times, so that essentially by unifying Christians and Jews to sort of take over the land of Israel, to eliminate the Islamic heathen, to set up this new Judeo-Christian kingdom that would enable the second coming of Christ to arrive. This was sort of, they wanted to use the strategies of the Russian avant-garde because, you know, the Russian avant-garde were very utopian about their beliefs, right? Like, they were making visual things that were going to literally transform the world. They were educating others, but in some ways, the creation of these things were embodying that kind of change. And there was a sound piece by a real Reverend John Hagee that went along with it.
I hope you brought your Bibles tonight because I'm going to give you the mother load, the Word of God. There's a battle going on in this nation right now between the President of the United States and the liberal left that's doing everything to fight
that's
him. The gospel truth.
That's the gospel truth.
God did not loan the land to Israel. He gave it to them forever and forever and forever. Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God. And for those of you who believe and have been taught that Christianity and Islam are sister faiths, you're in great deception. We are not sister faiths. Most Arabs are Islamic fundamentalists. Their ambition is the destruction of Israel and the control of the city of Jerusalem. Jesus Christ. The battle for Jerusalem has begun. There's 100 million people willing to kill you. That's not a very comforting fact. Hitler didn't have nearly that many people under his command. The real God is not Allah. It is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's the real God. It cannot be altered by the President of the United States. It cannot be altered by the United Nations. It cannot be altered by the Palestinians or the Russians. It belongs to Israel, period. Let the Holy Spirit fill this house tonight. George Bush is doing his absolute best to defend this country from terrorism, and it's time for every American to stand up and support him against the left that's trying to make it not happen, because he is the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords, and out of his mouth.
If Iran is stopped, it will require the military force that only America and Israel have. I believe this military action could very probably lead Russia to begin the coalition of Islamic nations. That would be Iran, Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, to attack Israel as is presented in the Word of God.
Bible prophecy presents, at the end of the age, four great superpowers. And those four great superpowers are simply presented in the Bible as the King of the North, which is Russia, the King of the South, which is the coalition of Arab nations, the King of the West, which is Europe and America, and the King of the East, which is China. I remind you, on 9/11, we were attacked. 9/11 proved that Islam has the will to destroy us because the Arabs feared the Word of God.
Ready for the final, ready for the final, ready for the final.
Because he is the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords. And out of his
the next time he comes back, Hitler will be dragged before him. You can hear the thundering hoofbeats of the four horsemen of the apocalypse racing toward the battle of Armageddon.
Make no mistake about it, that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, could literally, physically, personally return to earth this year without violating one Bible verse.
The King
King of all kings and the Lord of all lords, because he is the King of all kings. The Church of Jesus Christ is suddenly raptured from this church. King of all kings and the Lord of all lords. Because the next time he comes, he will put his foot on the Mount of Olives. It will split in half. He will walk across the Kidron Valley and through the Messiah's gate and sit on the throne on the Temple Mount. It will be the throne of his father David, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. Shout for joy, Church of Jesus Christ. The King of glory is coming with power and great glory. King of all kings and the Lord of all lords, because he is the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords, because he is the King of all kings and the Lord of all lords.
So this show was made it sort of in response to a bunch of questions that I had been getting about sort of my work up until then, which is also questions that I had as well. Basically, what does the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have to do with America, you know, or Americans, or sort of everyday people, living in Dallas or Fort Worth. And the interesting thing to me was, like, here was essentially a Texan Christian who spelled it all out, at least from one perspective, you know, who wasn't just implicating the relationship between sort of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict politically to America, but also was sort of doing essentially this kind of biblical exegesis, like, you know, tying together contemporary politics and, you know, biblical scripture, and finding this whole set of relationships that existed between all of them. I got someone to work with me on creating these silkscreen prints, these posters. So here on the left was basically the New Elders of Zion. That was like their band poster, you know, This Is Us. And on the right was another sort of piece of propaganda where, you know, they took a quote from the Reverend John Hagee and put it together with this quote from Pope Urban II, who was, one of the first people to start the Crusades. So I don't know if you've ever heard of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Basically, it was an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that was started in Russia around 1903. And on the upper left is it published in England in 1920. On the upper right was one of the Russian versions on the inside flap. The middle is a more contemporary Russian version. On the bottom right is a 2005 published copy in Mexico. And on the left is a 2005 published copy from Syria. Essentially, the idea behind this text, which ultimately was a hoax, was sort of this idea of the sort of Jewish cabal that, you know, met to figure out a way to rule the world. And this group, the New Elders of Zion, wanted to sort of riff off of that, because the older conspiracy theory was about this sort of the insidious Jews in Western culture. This new conspiracy theory was about the insidious Muslims and Arabs within Western culture. And so they rewrote the Protocols of Zion for sort of the New Elders of Zion. So these are broadsheets, essentially, of what the new protocols were. There were 25 in the original, and I rewrote 25 of them. I kept one exactly the same, which was number 15. Create the impression of the existence of freedom of press, freedom of speech, democracy, and human rights, all of which are subsequently undermined and become mere illusions or deceptive smokescreens behind which actual oppression lies. Again, these were designed to mimic Russian avant-garde design. And within the exhibition were also these drawings, and there was a fictional art historian who wrote these wall texts. His name was Dr. Nissim Hosblat from Hebrew University. It's an anagram for my name. And he and I collaborated on the exhibition, and one of the things that we described was sort of this rift that existed within this group, the New Elders of Zion. There was one side that really believed in, you know, sort of the posters as the way to sort of spread the word that would have, you know, real imagery and text, things that are easily recognizable. And then another group that wanted to hold to the prohibition of images from Genesis, that really thought that abstract iconography was the only way to go. And so, you know, we displayed examples of both sides from this group. As you can see, it's sort of the same motifs from the earlier drawings that have just basically become multiplied. As a part of this exhibition, there was a panel discussion where I invited an historian, Rick Halperin, who's the head of Amnesty International in America, and a theologian, Mark Chancy. And basically, we were talking about the relationship between divine right and human rights within the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It was really an incredible conversation because people in the audience came from, you know, from within the university, from history, poli-sci, art history, the religious studies department. There were faculty and students, plus people from the community at large who are Muslims, Christians, and Jews. These are some examples of some recent drawings, which is basically where I'm going to close, except for one last thing. So that's the most recent drawing. Okay, so Terry mentioned collecting collectivity, and the one thing that I want to say about sort of this project, the curatorial project, and Art Lies, is both basically were about collectivism, and collectivism really as a kind of political action. So I mentioned that in the first curatorial project that I was really using curation as a method to try to understand some conflicts that I had within my own artistic practice. In this show, basically, which brings together a whole bunch of people who are, you know, working together with this tension between the collecting of art objects versus political practice that sort of denies objects, and trying to find a way that they can coexist in some way. That was definitely true for the exhibition. These are some examples of the artists in the exhibition. And also the Art Lies issue, which we spent a lot of time actually trying very hard to find artists that were looking as closely as possible at artists that were today engaged with political practice that wasn't sort of nostalgic for some ideas of sort of 60s or 70s political practice, but was engaged with the issues today. And, you know, both of these projects, I think, for me, are were a way for me to sort of explore the way that other artists are dealing with the kinds of things that I'm working on, even though their work may not look the way mine does, and it doesn't necessarily deal with the same issues. But I was sort of interested in sort of setting up other kinds of dialogue that reflected the things that I was thinking about. So thank you very much. So I'm open to any questions. I know it got late.
Continuing this, these motifs and these things in other works, like do you have projects that you're wanting to do more with this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going back to Israel in July, and I'm actually going to spend 2 weeks with this program that the it's a group called the International Committee Against Housing Demolition, and it's a group that works to rebuild houses that have been basically Palestinian houses that have been destroyed by the Israeli authorities. So I'm going to spend 2 weeks, like literally, building these houses, and I'm going to be documenting that experience. So with video and audio interviews of all the people involved, which include Palestinians and a group of international activists that are going to be involved in that. So I don't know what form it'll take, but that'll be the start. Anyone else? Yeah.
Okay, but I'm just going to, first of all, I really love to see those last drawings. But I'm going to go back to the very beginning where you were talking
sure.
about the scenes from the film, and you were talking about the first scene being the circumcision, and you talked about circumcision as a self-inflicted mm-hmm. act. And you, that was a sentence after you said, this is the kid 8 days after he was born.
Yeah.
So I was trying to understand what how that you were understanding circumcision as a self-inflicted
right. act. I think what I mean by self-inflicted is through a kind of communal assumption. Do you know that, and especially since, that sure, I mean, that and that is the debate within circumcision, right? You know, and actually that's another piece that I'm actually, that has yet to be developed. So Derrida, who came up a few times, had a biographer write a biography about him, right? And then the underneath that was the kind of the commentary on the biography, and it was called Circumfession. Derrida, who's an Algerian Jew, writes a lot about his mother and how he would never, ever, ever circumcise his children for a lot of complex philosophical reasons. And one of them being that by his definition, as well as a lot of other people who are against it, that it's actually not self-inflicted, because the self has yet to, there's questions about whether the self has yet to develop and whether the self has any say in it whatsoever. In that particular instance, what I was interested in was the self on a communal level. So the community, sort of the Jewish community, inflicts this sense of identity on itself. And then, you know, the flip side of that with Kristallnacht is that another community inflicts this identity on a community that is set as other. So it's not individual, but more communal on that level. Anyone else?
So what do you think about abstract form?
I think that in some ways these are still experiments, because it's the thing that I'm still struggling with is whether or not the drawings can stand on their own. Mm-hmm. Because I've shown them in group shows, but I have yet to sort of do a whole show that's just the drawings on their own. That's really also sort of tied to all the stuff that I was talking about with declaring space, right? Like, you know, how much in any piece of work, you know, and any piece of art, be sort of really understood on its own terms. And that can go sort of pro or con in terms of like showing it, right? Like on the one hand, I could say, oh, well, I'll just show the drawings because it's the viewer's job to sort of unpack it and do the research and, you know, figure out the rest of it. And that it exists to some degree as a trace of the larger body of work, all of these other installations. But on the other hand, I'm still unsure whether that stretch is too much. Honestly.
But if you unpack it for them,
yeah.
there's complication of that as well.
Exactly. And there's different layers. I mean, that's one of the reasons why a lot of the text that's being read wasn't always audible, you know, or like that you couldn't always understand it.
Right.
I was interested in sort of layering these statements on top of one another, where like you could get pieces of it that emerge without it really following a sort of standard documentary form that explains in a very direct way something. So that's been one strategy to try to obscure even within the explanation so it doesn't become too didactic. But I think that that's the question that still drives the drawings themselves, is like, how can I do something within these drawings that they can stand up on their own?
So when you define yourself as an artist,
sure.
And this, I'm going to draw some comparison to what I do. I think it's
sure.
interesting that you use text,
sure.
because I love using text. I've done some work, electronic uh-huh. acoustic work,
sure.
And I'm a music composer, but
sure.
I'm very drawn to like interview text or like getting people to read a text and doing things with it. And that's the reason. It's almost like, do you consider yourself? Like all these different labels, like I'm a drawer, I'm a painter,
sure.
I'm a composer, and that's how you label yourself an artist.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's like all of that together makes this
right.
one thing.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I'd say that. I mean, one of the artists that was in the Collecting Collectivity exhibition, Julie Ault, gave a lecture at SMU recently where she sort of had a map of her practice, which had sort of a little rectangle for her curatorial practice, a little rectangle for her writing, you know, and these things were these rectangles that sort of overlapped, you know, sort of for teaching practice, and then there was sort of one large, like, rectangle that was artist that sort of encompassed all of them. And there was something in sort of seeing that moment where I was like, oh yeah, that's, you know. Yeah.
Max. Well, two questions. One is the black cube, which I think is an interesting inclusion. Is it representative of the cabaret in some way?
Yeah.
And then secondly, it seems as though a lot of the investigation, which I'm you know, bewildered with and interested in and compelled to see more of, investigates the notions or the maybe the byproduct of the enmeshing, cultural enmeshing of all of these three mm-hmm. different primary, you know, religions
yeah.
being in such a close proximity of one another. And, you know, we see it in the news, and we see it in the media, we see it,
right.
read about it. And it's been a pretty impactful thing for the last, who knows how many years. But and so what's interesting is that all these icons and all these images start to come together, and they seem as though, to some degree, like self-portraits, and then also in the same way like Malcolm X went and investigated his own
sure.
past and found as a kind of self, cultural self-portrait. And in the beginning, you were looking at text very, you know, very specifically. I'm just interested if that investigation from an iconic, maybe cultural, you know, current eventish kind of investigation has sort of bridged the gap with this the emergence of the text from these you know different religions uh-huh. and these different you know some people say that they're quite different
sure
and some people that say that there's
sure
quite a lot of overlap and so
well I think I mean there's two points in there. The first one, just before I forget, was related to Terry's question about the drawings, because one strategy within this drawing was to actually make the cube black, to more explicitly reference the Kaaba, right? And yeah, like in terms of all of the stuff that about self and other that I was talking about, that you know, using the colors of the Palestinian flag becomes just as much a sense of self-portrait as it is, you know, sort of a portrait of the other, because the two really become one. As far as the notion of text, I basically thought of using the found film footage, things from documentary and the media, as a kind of text. And especially in the second video that I showed, where you start to see this relationship between these sort of groups marching in unison, you could see like a group of sort of Israeli soldiers, of Jewish refugees, of Palestinians during the first Intifada, and of Nazi soldiers. And I mean, that's the stuff that's actually been quite disturbing to a lot of people, because you know that first video when I showed it one person, they were sure that I was equating Palestinians with Nazis, and I showed it the same thing to another person, and they were positive that I was equating sort of Jewish soldiers with Nazis, and both basically spoke a lot about how each of those people were sort of like bringing themselves to the table. Okay. Well, thank you all very much.